Thanks for checking out the Eastern Current Saltwater Fishing Podcast presented by Florida Fishing Products. I've been fishing the Florida reels for a few seasons now, and I've been nothing but impressed. The quality and durability of the reels are second to none. The Solas, Bahia, and Osprey CE cover all the bases for your inshore light tackle setups, whether you're a weekend warrior or a year-round guide. If you like pulling on big fish, they also have you covered with the Resolute Series reels. Go check out their reels online at floridafishingproducts.com or click the link in the podcast show notes. Today I have the privilege of sitting down with Captain Jason of Blitzbound Guide Service up on the New Jersey coast. We talk all about fly fishing for giant stripers, and I know y'all are going to enjoy the episode. Stay tuned. If you're like us here at Eastern Current, your boat trailer takes a beating. That's why we want to tell you about Coastal Trailer Repair, located here in Wilmington, North Carolina. At Coastal Trailer Repair, they strive to bring quality work at a reasonable price, specializing in trailer hubs, springs, and all things electrical and wiring. If you have an issue with your trailer, look no further than Coastal Trailer Repair to get you back on the road. You can find their information in the podcast show notes. Captain Jason, thank you for joining me on the podcast. You reminded me that I think, how long have we been trying to do this?
A little over 4 years now, my man.
Well, we've become good social media friends through that. So our business, or my lack of commitment, one of the two, has created a friendship.
Yeah, well, I was a little lack of committing too as well. I always wanted to do it, and I'm flattered to that you asked me. I'm really happy to be here, bud.
Right on, man. Well, let's start out how we start out most podcasts with new guests and kind of hear your backstory, where you grew up, how you fell in love with the outdoors. It looks like you're a lot like me where, you know, fishing is a big part of it, but you dabble in a lot of outdoor activities. So just give me your story from, you know, as a child to now, kind of falling in love with the outdoors.
Yeah, I'll give it to you. It's, much like you, we discussed before, little kid, all I want to do is fish. That is all I ever wanted to do. Actually from Pittsburgh, grew up in Ridgefield, Connecticut then. And wanted to actually do a couple of things, fish, play sports, and, you know, maybe chase girls as we got a little later in life there. But, that's really all I wanted to do. It's an obsession. People say, oh yeah, I like to fly fish, or maybe I like to bird hunt, and that's great. People say I'm a huge fly fisherman. I don't think they get it. That's why we're probably fishing guides. It's all we think about. It's really a terrible obsession. So I've been, fortunate enough to kind of fall into some good people, some folks who taught me some things through the years. Working in a fly shop, started my fly fishing business about a little over 20 years ago, 22 years ago now. I started that on Long Island. So I would fish the North Shore, Long Island, some of the South Shore, and then Montauk. Then about 15 years ago, I moved to New Jersey. So I started working in the New Jersey area as well. And I always did some trout fishing, which I really, you know, the technical trout fishing on the upper Delaware River in the Catskill Mountains is one of my absolute favorite things to do on a drift boat. So I always kind of kept that for my pleasure, but I transitioned that into work as well. So I kind of have all the waters in the Northeast covered, really.
That's cool. That's cool. Now, when did the hunting come into play for you?
Yeah, the hunting, you know, Chad, I wish I could talk. You know, I know my limitations. I know there's so many guys. There's so many guys I sit and talk about hunting with, and I'm not the guy who's sitting in the woods. I'm not tracking a deer. I don't shoot many turkeys. None of that stuff. But what I got is I got a couple of bird dogs who I always wanted bird dogs. And I've only had them for 12, 13 years. But, you know, when I get into something, I really get into it hard. I started talking to dudes who know a lot about upland bird hunting. I started watching videos, reading books, and just fortune. There's a lot of good bird hunting, although not wild birds around here in New Jersey. But, there's a lot of good public land with some stock birds. And I just joined actually a club over the past year that has some. They're putting quail out twice a week, and they're all over the 1,000-acre property. Favorite thing in the world is watching those dogs work and carrying, you know, a nice old classic shotgun trying to shoot those damn things.
Right. I've fallen in love with the bird hunting myself as well. Did it with my dad growing up as a kid and enjoyed it, but the past 4 or 5 years I've really dove back into it. And that's something I kind of keep to myself. I run a few hunts just if I have an open day and the weather looks good, but it is so special to watch bird dogs work. And we have a good population of wild quail in a large game land section that's near my house. And then we've also got a lot of woodcock here in the winter. So it provides a good opportunity to go out and have some good wild bird contacts with the dogs, which is fun. But no one's on this podcast really to listen to me talk about bird hunting. We want to hear about your fishing stories. But, um, But yeah, that's cool, man. I think that you sound a lot like me, where if you get into something, it's like you're all into it. Like right now with my son, it's dirt bikes. Like he's gotten into dirt bikes, and now we're just obsessed and riding dirt bikes all the time when we're not on the water. So it's good for the boy and
good for you. I have a son too, so it's good for the son. It's good for you as well.
Right, exactly. It's fun. Anything I can do to stay outside with the kids instead of inside, so it's always nice. But yeah. So when in your life did you decide, hey, I want to take this fishing passion of mine to make a job out of it instead of just a hobby?
No, it's always been like that. I mean, it was funny. Like it was even as a little kid, you know what I wanted in second, third, fourth grade. My aspiration was to actually own a fly shop.
Who would have thunk that, man?
I was just, it's funny, a couple of weeks ago, the Bass Pro catalog came. You know, I'm over 50 years old now. I sit there, I look at every page of it. So when I was a little kid, you looked at that Bass Pro Shop catalog, you looked at this, even the Sears catalog with the fishing stuff. It's just, it just becomes, a bit of an obsession. And, you know, it's been in there since I was a little kid, whether I'm starting out, you know, on farm ponds or bass. I think by fifth grade, I was really heavily into the fly fishing. I didn't know what the hell I was doing, but boy, I wanted to fly fish.
Right. That's cool. That's super cool. So I'm trying to think of how to phrase this question, but we're all drawn to fishing, I feel like, for some similar reasons, a lot of similar reasons, but are there any specifics to you that it really kind of where that root is drawn, I guess, from? Like what is your favorite type of fishing and why are you really obsessed with it?
Well, I'll tell you what, man, I can talk about all kind of fishing because whatever fishing I'm doing at a particular time, whether it's, you know, throwing dry flies for trout for my drift bait or having guys do it, I'm not fishing much anymore. They're trying to get a 50 pound plus striper with a fly, whether it's black line or maybe, you know, teasing them up. It's in that moment, it's all phenomenal. But what really has drawn me to the whole, I don't know, would say fishing lifestyle is my, you know, all the boys in the Northeast, we all go to the fly show, we all talk about, we all say it's all about the hang. So when I got, what draws me to it as much as the fishing is all these dudes who I am brothers with. We all share this exact same passion. We're together in the morning having coffee, getting our boats ready, our drift boats, or we're on the dock and our big boats ready talking about. We're out on the water talking about, we get back, hey, have a few beers, let's clean our boats. It is really about, you know, kind of the brothers, you know, the whole brotherhood of it.
Yeah.
It's really a very special thing for me. It's almost as good as the actual being out there fishing.
Yeah, I agree, man. It's cool to find that community, that place that you fit in. Like in life, I feel like whether it's fishing or whatever anyone's hobby might be, you know, that finding that sense of community is such a valuable and needed part of life. And I feel like fishing provides such a good community for people. Which is something I'm real drawn to as well. And have my close buddies where we fish all day. As soon as I get in the truck, I'm calling one of them or all of them. We're talking on the phone about what we saw, you know, why it sucked, why it was good, kind of just downloading all the time, laughing about our mistakes, you know, cheering each other on for our victories. It is a cool community.
You know what it is? It's like a support system. I was talking to my father recently, very close to my father, best man I ever knew. He passed recently. I spent a lot of time with him. He said, oh, geez, I want to go bird hunting. I want to watch tippet and trout work. So he got into bird hunting real late in life. He's an 80-year-old guy taking a hunter safety course, but he did it. Especially over the past few years before we lost him, he was with me an awful lot. And he'd come out to Montauk and I'd be like, oh yeah, I can't take you out on the boat because I'm working every day. He said, Jason, I'll walk around the beach. I'll meet you at the dock. I can't wait. And he would see me with my friends. He'd look at me and he'd know. I'd call my one buddy, Stevie, who's a guide on the Delaware. And he says, Jason, that's great. You know, I love your friends. These guys are terrific. How often do you talk to him? I said, Dad, I talk to him every day.
Yeah.
Said, what are you talking to? I said, Dad, I talk to him every, I talk three or four guys every single day. We text all the time. These guys are my brothers. He says, it makes him happy. It's such a support system. He's really proud of that, and it's a neat thing.
For sure, it really is. It's cool to have that brotherhood, like you said, community brotherhood, whatever you want to call it. It's a special thing in fishing, and you find the same thing in hunting. And I've even found the same thing. Not to talk about dirt bikes again, but and the one thing I found about in the dirt bike community, which is a little bit different than the fishing, is like very accepting a lot of times of new people. And in the fishing world, sometimes it's a little bit harder to get into that community sometimes because of not the competitive nature, but you know, you got to kind of keep your stuff a little secret because there's a lot of people fishing and you got to have your own little stuff. And so that's one of the one of the cool things and the drawbacks of the fishing world. I mean, I love to share. I love to provide value to others. But some of the stuff you got to keep under your hat, you know, and be a little bit more tight knit about. But I don't know. Is that something that y'all see up there in your fishing communities as well?
Yeah, I mean, let's call it space. But we're fishermen. We became fishermen. We became guys. We're pretty damn good at it. And I like to say I don't have a big ego about it or anything a lot, but we do have a little bit of pride in it. So we do. There's some, you know, we protect things or we look at maybe newcomers a little bit leery, you know, stuff like that. But you and I had spoken before when we were off recordings about social media.
Right.
You see all these new folks coming. Hey, you know, during COVID, this dude's, this is how to catch a striper in 4 feet of water on you know, off of Long Island. They started doing these younger guys, or maybe even not so younger, just new to the sport, and they started doing it. And now 4, 5, 6 years later, these guys are going to be guys. You know what, John? I got to tell you, I kind of dig it. I like looking at the social media. I like to see what these young dudes are doing, thinking outside the box, taking sick pictures, recording what they're doing. I kind of like it. So I'm, as long as there's that, you know, as long as these guys are coming up through the ranks and show some, not respect, it's not like reverence or anything, but saying, hey, man, I know you've been doing it for a long time. This shit's cool. I'm going to be looking at these guys and say, hey, you've been doing it 4 years. Look at that frigging picture. That's badass. You guys are really good. You guys are good at fishing. You know what? The younger dudes, I'm getting a little bit older. I think I still go very hard, but these guys go really hard. And I kind of respect that. I like to see it.
Absolutely. I agree. It's cool, and it keeps you on your toes. Like, it keeps you having to be competitive in your marketing and having to, you know, you start to realize, like, you can get complacent as a guide, especially the longer you do it, to feel like you might kind of have something locked down or understand something fully, and then all of a sudden you're like, oh, wait, no, I don't. This guy's showing me that there's a lot left to learn that I kind of thought I already knew. And so it keeps you pushing and growing to become a better angler, essentially. So I think it's a cool thing as well. And, you know, so many people knock social media. I've knocked social media, but I also am a big, you know, user of social media. And at the end of the day, if social media causes more people to get outside and to fish and to hunt and to be in the outdoors, that's a good thing. I mean, yeah, maybe it's the flat I wanted to pull. There was somebody on it. And 10 years ago, I'd never see a boat around there. But that's a dude who has found a passion and is enjoying the outdoors. And so you can't knock him for that by any means.
Yeah, really well, good way to put it there.
Thank you. So I want to hear a little bit about your seasons and how you guide, because you do travel around a bit, it seems. And kind of take me through what your year looks like guiding-wise, where you are and what you target.
Yeah, I can cut that up probably in four pieces. Four pieces, three different pieces of water. It's incredible. I'm here in New Jersey. I'm in Lincroft, New Jersey right now. I will fish come really next month, end of March, going into April, you know, awfully early, a lot of people think, but Raritan Bay, everyone's seen the pictures on the internet and stuff, the big fish coming out of there. It's bananas. I mean, this bay is, you know, on Jersey is one side and Staten Island is the other side. You know, you go around the corner, you can see up into New York City and to Brooklyn in no time. It's not like being out in Montauk, or it's not like being in the South, you know, the salt marshes in South Carolina or something. It's not ugly, but it's not all that pleasing. You don't have the big rock walls or any cliffs or anything like that. But what you have is just your big fish. And they're all, it's like every big striper is posting up in Raritan Bay in the early spring.
Wow.
Yeah, it is a world-class fishery. We have, I mean, over the past, really going hard, and maybe kind of, I wish I could say I have it pegged, I don't. But what I have is persistent. We always say to get these fish in Raritan Bay with a fly anyway, you have to be totally persistent. You can never stop because there's so much black line work, throwing big flies, you know, deeper water, 15, 20 feet of moving water. So you just have to stay after. But the amount of 50 pound fish I've caught on flies over the past 5 or 6 years it's crazy. I mean, we've actually, let's say the amount of 40 pound fish, because that's a bigger number. Over 50, I think we have 550s in the past 6 years.
That's awesome. And that's I mean, a fish over 40 is a fish of a lifetime, but a fish 50 or bigger, that's a true fish of a lifetime. Like, you're never going to beat it. Yeah,
it's absolutely nuts. And guys sometimes don't realize it either.
Yeah.
But, you know, you go out and the guy's maybe a newer angler doing what he's, because sometimes it's a little bit of guesswork as well. I get the 50-pound fish. He just does. Even a 40-pound fish, they don't realize how special that is, right, especially on bugs.
Right, exactly. Now, do you think those big fish showing up there, is that a water temperature-based thing, or are they kind of calendar migrators, or is it a little bit of both?
Yeah, calendar may be out the door because, you know, I think calendar's out the door because everything's a little bit different now. It used to be I'd get into that water. I'd get into that water a bit later because I'd really spend my earlier April into May on the river trout fishing. And then I'd come back. I'd be like, I know the bay bite has been good, so I'll get the last of the bay. And then all those fish will go out front and on their way up north, and we get the big blitzes out front in the warmer water in June. Now that's kind of over. Everything starts in really mid to late March and all through April, those fish are. So I don't think it's a temperature or calendar thing. I actually think it's a bait thing. We got the bunker here, and the bunker is thick at all times. In the spring, you have the big, big bunker. And in the fall, you have the big bunker, and you also have the peanuts as well.
Gotcha. And for everyone from down south by me, the pogie or the menhaden is what he's calling a bunker, which most people know. But that fish has so many names. menhaden. So the true old southern term of fat back for the menhaden is one that you don't hear much of anymore. But yeah, the bait is such a driving factor for those fish. And I just brought on a guy from the Chesapeake Bay. He's done some podcasts with me. He runs a guide service down there, but he's going to start hosting some episodes here on the Eastern Current platform. And he's saying that, I guess 2011 or so, they had 2011, 2012, they had just some exponential or some incredible spawn, some great spawn years. I'm trying to figure out the wording for this. And they've seen in the bay this year down there more big fish than they've seen, they're saying, in like 20 or 30, 40 years. Is that something that you've kind of seen up in your area as well the past few years?
Yeah, no doubt. I wish I could, you know, I hate to say that. I love this fisher. I make a good part of my living from fishing. I should be more adept at the conservation stuff. I spend time with the guys. I'm on a couple of platforms, but there's guys who really represent us so well in the conservation platform. It's a science. There's so many, what they're talking about now is, you know, they went to a slot limit, which, you know, take these smaller fish, which is surprising. We're trying to let those big fish live, you know, right, 'cause all the party boats, everyone's getting those on the big bait. So they're letting the smaller fish go. There's several years, you know, it's tough to tell. A lot of guys say, geez, I just crushed them all fall. We had fish up. Problem is those fish, there's only a couple year classes of those fish right in the bay at that time. I think that there's certain year classes that were missing. Some of those old 2011s, those enormous fish now, are pretty strong still.
Yeah.
So I know where he's coming from. Those, the big, I've never seen big fish like I have consistently over the past 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, that's cool. And those are all the same, essentially kind of the same body of fish moving all the way down to the bay and then all the way up to where you are?
I think you're right on that. I think there's a couple different bodies because I think there's some fish going to the bay and then there's also some big fish going up the Hudson.
Gotcha.
And I think, you know what I mean? So I think there's, you know, or wherever they're going to be spawning, but I think the two main avenues is going down south to the bay and then up to the Hudson.
Now, how many tributaries off the Hudson do those fish move into to spawn? Is there just one main one or are there a handful of them?
I wish I can't say for sure. I don't run all the way up there.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
they go pretty far upstate. It is kind of funny in that you know, you have a nice run of big fish in the spring and then boom, they kind of disappear. Like, where the hell are these fish? Well, those fish are up spawning. And that's, yeah, you know, sometime in late April into May, we have a little bit lull and they come back out and, you know, come out eating the bay again and then head up north.
That's cool. That's super cool. So when you finish up with your early spring, you know, big stripers there, what's the next season kind of roll into?
I'll stick there for a while, and just if I can finish that out, I didn't really touch on the fishing. We got a couple of things going, and that early spring fishing is, it's bananas, because you are catching big animals on a fly rod, and we're doing it a couple of different ways. As I said before, it's mostly a black line thing, and it's funny, if you have a chartreuse fly with a white belly, you're going to get a few fish. However, if you have an all chartreuse fly, you're going to get much more fish.
Wow.
What Lefty said, if it ain't chartreuse, it ain't no use.
Yeah.
It's kind of true at that time of year. You know, the bigger, the better, and as bright as possible, because the water is somewhat tainted at that time of year. And there's just an awful lot of competition. There's a lot of guys who know the big fish are out there. There's a lot of guys from Jersey, from New York, all running to the same place. So you're oftentimes, my guys are or you know, I have two terrific fly casters, let's say, and they're throwing 450 grain sink temp lines with a, you know, 10 inch hollow fly deceiver type fly, all chartreuse. But, you know, right next to us is a charter boat throwing, you know, six or eight live baits off the front or in off the back as well. It's there's a lot of competition. So to get to those fish, you need to be relentless. But once those fish start to break up a little bit in the bay, they go out front to the ocean side. That's when it really gets fun because all the fish are spread out. You have to just check each bunker school to see if any of them are active. And oftentimes I'm throwing a big hookless plug. I throw it 1,000 times a day and just trying to tease those fish up. And as soon as we get a blow up, the guys are throwing with intermediate lines as well, 10, 11 weights, an 8 to 10 inch fly right to the blow up. And we're, you know, 9 times out of 10, we're going to get a hookup out of that.
That's cool.
Really cool thing.
That bait and switch, like teasing them up with the topwater, man, stripers are probably the best fish I've ever been able to pull that off with. They're just so, they'll stay on a plug so well. Like once they decide to follow it, it seems like they'll chase it all the way to the boat. Pretty cool.
Yeah, they'll stay to the boat. I'll tell you, a lot of times most guys pull that plug out as fast as they can once they have a fish on it. Sometimes I leave that damn thing in there and the guys are throwing. There's one fish. There's always going to be two or three.
Right.
They'll peel off. If you have a fly moving right by the plug, they'll go to that fly as well.
That's cool. That's super.
Yeah,
cool.
There's no, and what I'll tell you, one thing interesting, Judd, is you know, so many classic striper places where I'll talk about later, for instance, Montauk or, you know, Fisher's Island, they all have rocks. They all got structure. The New Jersey Shore doesn't have structure. We got moving bait balls. That's about it. I don't have structure. We're about 7 miles down the beach, which is Shrewsbury Rocks. So it really is a game of being relentless, just running my boat as much as I can to find the active bunker school.
Yeah. And you're running, the boat you're running is a pair, right, out of North Carolina?
Yep, it's a pair out of North Carolina. We can spend a few minutes talking about, I've been through them all, and I, you know, I always say I'm not a boater. I'm a fisherman. I use that thing as a tool. But
right.
Boy, man, Brian Pear has built one sick inshore fishing machine.
Yeah, it is a really, really cool boat. Take me through how you've got your setup for your inshore fishing.
I've always been a Jones Brothers guy, and Donnie Jones, great guy, builds a nice boat. It's a modified V boat, and they're lighter. And I was, you know, again, you've been doing this long enough, you do enough days on the water, you start to get beat up. Always said, I want a bigger boat. So first, Brian said, I got introduced to Brian to a buddy. He said, Jace, come look at my 24 modified V. It looked like a big Jones Brothers with a bracket on a 300 engine. It was nice. It was heavy boat, doesn't move. And it was modified V. I said, Brian, this boat's phenomenal. I'm gonna run it. Thank you so much. I love it. It's great to work out of. However, if you ever build the same hull with a deeper V, you know, 20, 22, 24 degree dead rise, you're going to crush it in the Northeast, because that's what everyone wants to go near offshore. Everyone wants to, and the fact of the matter is we're always in big water here. It's always
right.
Friggin' blowing here. So a couple of years later, he had built it. And he said, Jake, trade your boat in or sell your boat. I'm going to give you a good deal on one of these. You told me to buy it. Come down, buy one. Let's build one for you. So I got a 24 deep V, which is 24 degree dead rise, weighs a ton. A bracketed boat. I have twin two. I never in my life thought I'd have twin engines on. I can't tell you how much I like twins. And this thing just makes my life easy. Really does. It just eats the, you know, I don't want to go offshore with it, to be honest with you, because it's still a 24-foot boat, and it's a 22 degree dead rise boat. I can pick my days, but I don't want to come home in fives, you know, for
right,
50 miles.
Right.
But anything the inshore throws at me, it just eats it up. It is an absolute pleasure. It's also a low gunnel boat, so the guys love the fish out of it.
Yeah, that's one of the big downfalls of a lot of the older boats of that style is the higher gunnels. Hard to fly cast, hard to work a topwater plug with a spin rod. Building those floors up higher, or essentially the gunnels lower, is such a nice touch for that. You see a lot of boats, even Florida style, like center consoles, doing that now.
Yeah, you look for three things. You look for those lower gunnels, for sure. You look for no step up in front as well. And you look for overall fishability if you can walk around the boat. And that's
right.
And the fourth thing is, I think, almost the most important is the stability. Mine's not a 24 degree dead rise boat. So it's a wide boat. So it's not so tippy at rest. It may not skip over the water like a contender 25. However, it's going to still land relatively softly. But once I get to those fishing grounds, it is not rocking.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, in the big water on a tippy boat, really not the best, especially for a fly caster.
Yeah, I mean, if you've got a spin rod, you can lean up against the console and throw when you're tipping back and forth. But with a fly rod, when you got to make a long cast and you're already rocking and the boat's rocking, it makes it much tougher. Much, much tougher.
Yeah, it sure does.
All right, so after your striper season, or how long are you striper fishing? Does that kind of take you up the coast? Do you follow them up the coast?
No, I'll do a little bit. So, you know, again, April, I'll start early in April, and then I'll start getting that trout bug too. The I know this is a saltwater podcast, but, you know,
type of fishing, we love.
This whole upper Delaware River system, it's kind of where fly fishing was born in America. Such a steeped in tradition. And it's funny, we fish this system called the Delaware River, and it's they have a west branch, they have an east branch, they have in the main stem, and it's a big water, it's like western looking water, and a lot of I run a drift boat on it, and the thing about it is it's technical as hell. You're not, these are all wild fish. You are not catching a fish unless you have your A game. And yeah. I hate to say it, I have dudes who absolutely love it, and sometimes they're not catching a fish because I say, hey man, it's worth here. I'm a guide, not a god. That fish is working 35 feet right down from us. You have to put a good reach cast on it. You have to do everything right to catch one of these fish. And on any given weekend up there, you'll see all the hot shot. Every fishing guide I know loves going up to the Delaware to fish.
Yeah.
They all love it because, yeah, it's really just such a technical fishery. And again, it's a good hang. It's a really good hang because all the boys are getting together after every trip. We all fish well into the night. And the place I stay is my best friend has a house up on the mountain he uses as a lodge. And I take my clients and, you know, my three or four best buds up there who are all fishing guides, they take their clients. We're there together every night. It's pretty special.
Yeah, that is super cool. That's that's one of the things that I feel like the freshwater world of fly fishing has a little. You find that kind of like good hang a little bit easier in the freshwater world. The saltwater world is not quite. I don't know why it's not quite the same, but at least not in our area.
Yeah, I kind of have it the same in Montauk, but I'll get to that just if I can go. You know what I'm doing then. You know, especially later into April and all through May, I'm going back and forth. I'll spend 3 days upstate, 3 day trip in a row, then pop home for a family day, and then maybe 2 days on the water in salt water, and then do it all again. You always have that fear of missing out. I hate, you know what it is, that everyone talks about FOMO.
Right,
I may be catching 45-pound bass on the ocean. You know, whether it's up front or maybe in the bay, and then my buddies are calling me and say, "Hey, the Hendrickson's really pouring off. We're getting the dry fly fishing so good." So you always have that. Oh, geez, I wish I was there.
Right.
But it's either way is great. You know, sometimes I will be getting those big fish or on the dry fly up on the river, and my guys are saying, "Jace, we're getting 40-pounders here." So you know, then it goes both ways. So it's kind of the best of both worlds. I will fish. I will really fish both the fresh and the salt all the way through June.
Okay.
You know, pretty hard. You know, it's one, they kind of both peter off at the same time because the warm water, to tell you the truth.
Yeah. Well,
it's
nice to have that back and forth to kind of help with the burnout a little bit. If you're doing the same thing every single day, it can not, I mean, it's harder to keep it fresh. That makes sense.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. I'm thrilled to be able to have it. I'm thrilled to be able to know enough to guide on those two pieces of water all through the spring. It's you know, I'm honestly flattered that people are paying me to go fishing. We have a great time. It's not only about the fishing, it's how you treat these people on the boat too. You know, you're half an entertainer on a boat, you know, a quarter coach and a quarter fishing guide a lot of the time.
Absolutely.
So it's really special. It's funny, on my, I go into the supermarket up in Hancock, New York, and guys will stop me and say, "Oh, you're that fishing guide with the dogs." Because I always take my bird dogs on the boat with me.
That's awesome.
They're extremely well behaved. No one really. Most of the time, I only take one. Tippett, I've had for 11 years. He hasn't missed a float trip. Not a single float trip in 11 years.
God, that's cool.
It's pretty cool. And everyone's like, I had a guy call last year. He says, are you booked May 17th? And I said, "No, we're good to go. I got you for the river. Thanks." And I said, "You know what? I better call him back." I said, "Sir, are you going to have one guy or two guy? I just want to know." And he says, "Well, does that affect the price?" I said, "No, it doesn't affect the price. It affects how many bird dogs I'm going to bring on the boat with me." And he says, "I was going to take two guys. So I was going to take a partner with me. I don't think they'd appreciate sharing a boat with a paid trip with a dog." I said, "Well, you know what? I'll try to find another guide. I'm booked that day."
Yeah.
Realizes. Everyone says, "I don't know about having a dog," but the dog's perfect. And someone takes a line off a reel, the dog walks away. Most of the time, he just, you know, sits and looks at me or my angler. It's pretty neat, pretty special experience for me.
Yeah, that is really, really cool. Now, that Delaware Upper Delaware fishing? Is it pretty big water? Can you get away with a like a skiff style drift boat, or what kind of boat are you floating in?
I'm floating a Hyde right now. I'm kind of actually in the process of making a change to a skiff style boat. It's called an Adipose. It's it's a pretty sweet ride. I think it's going to be the perfect boat for the Delaware. Maybe a little bit shallower running. It's still a relatively roomy. It's a skiff, but it's also a drift boat. It's kind of in between. But it's not a techie river as far as rowing, to tell you the truth. It's big water. It's big, somewhat flat water. There's not a lot of gradient. The one thing is you have to have some freeboard, because most of the time I'm rowing at night. I'm rowing in at 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock at night.
Gotcha.
And it does get rocky, especially as the water drops. So
yeah,
you need some freeboard there.
Gotcha. That makes sense for sure. So when you're fishing Montauk, is that through that same time frame, or is that a little bit later in the year?
No, so once June, end of June comes around, it's I'm not doing a heck of a lot. I'll try to do near offshore trip, maybe tuna, try tuna. That's kind of a young man's game. These guys leave at 2 a.m. and come back at 6 of the next night. Going 70 miles offshore, not really my game. I'll do the mahi stuff in the summertime and do some West Branch. The West Branch of the Delaware is closest to one of the reservoirs up there, so the water stays cold throughout the summer. So I'll do a few trips if I can every week up there. And then I start really getting going again in September, and that's when I move things to Montauk. I stay out there for a little less than a month. Maybe sometimes it used to be a little more than a month. And Montauk was just the place to fish. It's everyone knows about Montauk. It's 100 miles out into the Atlantic Ocean. The fish go by there, and the bass blitzes are epic. I'm sure you've seen the blitz pictures. And the albacore fishing has been really good as well. So that's where all, it's, we go out there, and Captain Paul Dixon's kind of the leader of the crew. He's kind of developed that fishery, that light tackle fishery out there. All of the guys out there at one time or other chartered Paul, paid him when we were young and we were 25-year-old kids. Say, hey, Paul, can you take us fishing? Teach us how to do this. So he's kind of the leader of the crew. And I'm again, it's the whole hang thing. I have a house with three guys. Right down the street is another, three more of my best friends. We're all fishing guides. We're all together every single day. And just doing the really 7-to-4 thing on the water in Montauk.
That's super cool. Yeah, I've always wanted to get up there and fish Montauk.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm gonna tell you, it's become a tough fishery, and I'm hoping that this is just cyclical. It's been down the past couple of years. It's still good fishing. Don't get me wrong. We're getting people are going to come there no matter what, because it is a destination. It's a gorgeous place. It's, it's right through the Hamptons. You eat great dinners, great bars, rustic looking place. And it's just beautiful. And the fishing is good. We're going to have our shots. Over the past few years, the decline in the striped bass fishery, especially those certain year class fish, have not been there. So we haven't had the big blitzes under the lighthouse and stuff like that until later in the season. But what we have had are the albacore are moving in much more strong. So those false albacore, I'm sure are they're probably the ultimate saltwater fly rod fish.
Oh yeah, they're incredible.
Yeah, they really are. I mean, it's not an easy fish to catch, but if you have line control, if you make the cast, if you move that bug immediately, if you it's in the right direction, you're going to hook up, and then you have a nice fight on your hands after you do it. They really go.
Absolutely. What is y'all's size class on your albies up there that you see?
I'd say 7 to 10 pounds.
Yeah,
is really
hard.
Like, and the funny thing, 7 pounder fights as good as 10 pounder. It's incredible.
Absolutely. You really don't find a fighting difference in any size of I'd say 12 pounds and under. They all fight just super hard.
yeah, they do fight super hard. But what the cool thing is, I've landed, I've been doing this a long time. I've landed thousands of albacore, with the tail handle, and I pick them up every time. I look at the damn thing; they're freaking beautiful.
Oh, they
are. Just like when I land a brown trout, they're absolutely beautiful animals. I'm like, wow, this thing just gave us a fat tussle. Great fish for a fishing guide too, because once the dude hooks up, you can just kind of sit back on your leaning post and let him fight it for 10 minutes and relax.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, when it's really, really good, man, you can have people there like, all right, I've caught enough of those. I don't want to pull on them anymore. Especially when you're doing a little 8 weight or something. It's like, all right, well, yeah, I guess I've done my job.
Yeah, that's cool. The bar opens at 2, so we can go hang out for a while, boys.
Right, exactly. So does Montauk kind of wind down your fishing season for the most part?
Yeah, not absolutely. Montauk has become, and I don't want to sound, because this is my passion, but it's also business too. Montauk's my money making season, where I'll work every day for over 3 weeks, and a lot of times do 2-a-days. I come back from Montauk middle of October, and it is absolute game on in New Jersey. It's definitely my best fishing of the year.
Oh, wow. Nice.
No doubt. Yeah. It's because those peanut bunkerages, they're all over the bay. The fish are, you know, good fish. Maybe not the bigger, you know, 40s and 50 pounders. They're not in there. You're going to get a lot of anywhere from, I don't know, 12 to 25 pound fish. And a lot of them up all day long, like blitzing the surface. It is by far my easiest fishing and the best fishing for my clients. And that goes all the way. I'm usually done by Thanksgiving, but this fish is really still going.
Nice. Yeah, it seems like, man, no matter where you are, that September through mid-November is prime fishing for you know, whatever species you want to target or whatever species is in your area. That fall, that transition of bait flushing out and moving down the beaches, it just kind of triggers that fall bite. Everyone wants to target for whether it's redfish or tarpon or jacks or albies or any of that stuff. Stripers.
Yeah.
It's cool. We get a lot of, sorry, what were you saying?
No, good. Tell me what you get a lot of.
We get a lot of good striper. Our local river here, we have a lot of resident striper, and we get some really great topwater action in that November time frame as well. They're just looking up. It's like that last 30, 45 minutes of light as it's getting dark. They're just all over the surface.
Yeah, it's funny. When you say looking up, is probably the best fishing out of any type of fishing. You talk about trout for dry fly fishing. You talk about largemouth bass for, you know, throwing a buzz bait. Those fish are looking up. Throwing a frog, they're looking up. Throwing a dry fly, they're looking up. And then throwing, you know, intermediate line and just maybe a gurgler or a popper or a slider for the large striped bass. It's, you know, that whole visual thing is amazing.
Absolutely.
That's why this Jersey thing, I just can't, you know, I have guys coming from there, you know, a lot of, especially with this new, the pair customs have a real following. I have guys calling me saying, hey, I got this 21 pair. I see you're catching them good up there. Can I come up? Yeah, come up. Here's where I launch. Get out there. You'll catch them. And guys from all over the place, you know, as far down as, I guess, Virginia last year, a guy came up, and they're just, they can't believe the fishery we have up here in the late fall.
That's cool.
The fish are up all day long. It's a pretty neat thing.
Just packing the feed on for the colder months, for sure.
Yeah, they are. And so, you know, I'll go I admit I kind of run out of steam, and I run out of clients, too, to be quite honest with you. It's not as, you know, Jersey isn't the easiest place in the world to book. A lot of guys have done 3 or 4 trips with me already, and I'm kind of tapped out. I can't do anymore. So, you know, I work as hard as I can, get as many as I can for the for that time of year. And then by Thanksgiving, I'm kind of hanging it up and walking around the woods back, you know, behind the dogs.
Yeah, that's perfect, man. It's nice to take that break. And I feel one thing when I was young guiding, like I felt like I needed to guide it, be booked every single day of the whole year. And granted, it's great to have the ability to work, but taking a break and kind of resetting for the next season, I feel like just provides a better experience for your clients even, you know, anyways. And so it's nice to take some time off and to relax and kind of have a little time to yourself, because it is, people don't realize how much work guiding is from the early mornings, getting up, getting your boat ready. You know, it's a long, someone books a full day trip, it's a, you know, it's 12-13 hours for you by the time you're done with everything. So it's a lot of time spent.
It is a lot of time spent. I would say up in my north area, in northeast areas, I can count on one hand how many absolute full time guides who don't do anything else at all to make any other money. Just because of the season is, it's a temperamental season. And, you know, for myself, I do see a couple other things as well to make my life. Heck, I have to. I have 2 kids in high school, one going to college next year. So, but always in the forefront is the guiding. Everything is planned about around what you're going to be fishing wise.
Right.
But again, it's temperamental. You got wind. I mean, do I want to be in a spot where I need to check so bad, I need to get paid so bad that I'm going to take someone out when it's blowing 30 in the bay?
Right.
They can barely stand up. Yeah, we might get a few fish or not, but no, I kind of want to go on fishing trips to catch fish, not just a trip to go out there and maybe we can catch a fish. I really do, at this point in my career, I'm trying to align everything to make it, give the person the best opportunity to catch a fish, best conditions, you know, the best part of the run and stuff like that.
Yeah, and I think honesty with clients anglers really plays out into building a, you know, a lifelong client rather than just taking them out for that, just to get that one paycheck when it's blowing. But I mean, it's double-edged sword for sure. As far as that goes, it stinks to cancel, but then when it's, I mean, there's certain conditions where it's like, it's not worth it. You shouldn't be out there. So.
Yeah, that's very true. And the worst that it is when I'm in Montauk, we're renting a house, even though it's not a great house, it's really expensive. And you have your boat sitting there, it costs a couple grand to put your boat at a marina for a couple months. So you have serious overhead at that time because you're not fishing out of your home.
Right.
So you're saying, oh, geez, you know, I need to do 8 charters, 9 charters to pay for my experience out here before I start making money.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that is tough. That is very tough. That's one thing I've done over the past few years is really tighten up and just guiding around home. I used to travel a bunch with the seasons, but it is nice to stick around. And I miss the experiences and living with other guides and doing that, but it's nice to be back at my own house in the evening and with my family. So. And the money's better when you're not spending, when I'm not renting a house in Louisiana or, you know, something like that. So it's a good change for me, at least right now with young kids too.
Yeah, it is. It's, you know, I think my father would call it a high class problem. You know what I mean? Right. Saying, oh, geez, you got to stay home, but you got to stay home so you can fish more or make more money.
That's very true.
You know, I see, I always say, you know, hey, I'm a fly fisherman first, but one of my guilty pleasures, I watch professional bass fishing a lot, YouTube and stuff. I'm a major league fishing guy. I mean, I like bass, but I like that whole drama, that thing. But I look at these guys, I watch it, you know, just like everyone else, I watch a Jacob Wheeler podcast and stuff. These guys live the life that I think all of us guys who love fishing want to do. They hop in their pretty badass trucks with their badass boats, and they go from place to place, and they hang out with their buddies at night, and they fish hard every day, and they make a lot of money. When they're really good at their craft, and they are seriously the best fishermen I've ever seen, how they can do it so consistently. But it's kind of a really neat thing, and I think we're maybe getting what we're doing, whether it's the camaraderie, whether we're going to Montauk or you know, you're going to Louisiana or wherever we're doing it, we're getting a piece of that there. So it's a pretty neat thing.
For sure. Absolutely. That experience. And one thing I'm always so jealous about too, is their campers, you know, rigged out with all their campers pulled in beside each other. They're sitting on the bow of their boats, re-rigging rods after the day of tournament fishing. Yeah. It is cool. It's really, really fun to watch.
So one of my favorite things, you know what, before a trip, I love rigging rods. I like that. I guess I am a bit of a tackle geek. Worked in a fly shop for a long time. I love that stuff. I really do. You know, someone will hop on my boat and, hey, maybe I'm not the best fishing guide, or maybe I'm not in the best spot right now, then and there or something, but you know what? I'm going to have the best damn gear possible, and it's all going to work, you know, for that specific application. I really enjoy that, the tackle aspect of it.
Yeah, and one thing that I've learned, if you're not a great guide, if you have all your gear 100%, at least you can fool people a little bit.
I guess I fooled a few people, but I'm getting there. I honestly think, you know, it's funny, again, I'm going to say it for the 10th time, I'm getting old in the game. I've been doing it a long time, but man, I found some dudes, I learned so much, whether it's a younger person, how they're doing it when we go fishing together or see what they're doing, or I got this guy on the bay, you know, when I fish in the spring and in the fall, his name's Joe Maz, Mazman Charters, and he's just, you know, boat's not the best, his gear, I represent a better fly rod than him, but he'll laugh when I hear that. But the dude just gets it done because he's lived there. He's fished this water for over 50 years. He knows every damn rock, every damn seam, every damn drop off in that bay. And he's so good at feeding those fish. There's something to it. And we're all, let's say the spring, it's always the black line thing. He's so good at it. And we talk about it. And he's free with information with me. And we talk about, you know, how to feed him, you know, what technique and so forth. And you know what? He's made me such a, in the past 3 years, he's made me such a better fisherman.
That's cool. So
appreciate, you know, spending time with any guy. So I go down and see you, I'll fish with you and I'll take something home with me that you're doing and that applies to my water and to make it work a little better.
Agreed. I feel like we talk about that a lot on this podcast of how you can learn from every little scenario. Like you're dry fly fishing for trout. There's something to learn there to take back to the striper fishing and the big water, to take to red fishing, to take to tarpon fishing, line control, casting, slowing your cast. Just so many little things that, you know, across the board make you a better angler. As soon as you just pursue one avenue of fish or fishing and one fish and just kind of tunnel vision, there's nothing wrong with that, but you're going to stunt your growth as an angler. And as far as your, you know, your skill levels of different styles of that fishing go. So it's cool to stay diverse and to learn and to grow.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%.
So we're wrapping up here. We're about at 45 minutes. I usually try to keep it right around there. But before we wrap it up, I want to give you the chance to kind of share with people your social media, your website, how they can get up with you, to contact you if they want to get out and fish or just chat.
Oh, yeah, I'd love to. I mean, I've had this fancy website now for over 20 years. Dude, I eventually just put up a page that said, had a picture of both boats and saying my rates for where I'm fishing. Because everything I get is, I don't have a heck of a lot of new clients. I'd love to have some more new ones, but, you know, you get busy with your regulars. Everything's through the internet. Everything's through social media, I mean. So it would be Captain Jason Dapron at Blitzbound on both Facebook and on Instagram as well. So I try to, you know, I'm not a crazy poster, you know, on every story. Hey, I just had a really good cheeseburger at the dock. You're probably not going to see that on my Instagram page, nor are you going to see every fish, nor are you going to see every 17-pound bass or 17-inch trout I caught either. Right. You know, what I really try to do is say, hey, I'm a normal dude. I got these cool-looking bird dogs that come fishing with me. I have great experience. I got great buddies, and we fish some really pretty places, and I take care of my tackle. And that's what you're going to see on the website. On the Instagram page. It's more of a whole guide life type of thing. It's about the experience, I think. I get some good hits. I love it, too. I think, you know, might as well go with what you're good at. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And I'll tell you, I just got a new iPhone 15, so I'm like, wow. I tell my wife, I'm like, honey, I'm going to take some great pictures this year. Absolutely amazing what you can do with it. So, yeah, it's all neat stuff. So both, it's just my name, Captain Jason, and you can find it either under Captain Jason or Captain Jason Daper or Blitzbound on both those social media platforms.
Awesome. Well, man, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. You guys, thanks for listening to another episode. Hope y'all enjoyed this one like I did. And as always, we thank you for being a listener of Eastern Current. But man, Jason, that was fun. Can't wait to do it again. We'll have to get up there and fish with you sometimes. But thank you so much for joining us.
I'd love to have you. Thank you so much. Real pleasure. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Well, guys, we will see y'all on the next episode. Later.